This is John Bennett, and I'm going to be talking to you about otitis and sinusitis. Our three little monkeys here with ear, nose, and throat pain. I'm not going to be talking to you about throat pain because there's an outstanding talk by Karen Block on pharyngitis elsewhere in this program. So let's go on to otitis. Let's start with a picture of the anatomy of the ear. And the little star shows you the area of the external auditory canal that has cartilage around it. That's the external half of the external auditory canal. And that cartilage can become infected with Pseudomonas aeruginosa and cause external infection that's very serious called invasive otitis externa. This extends from the cartilage down into the bone and causes osteomyelitis, and that's why you treat it for 4 to 6 weeks. I put a little star here to remind you how thin the wall is between the top of the middle ear and the temporal lobe of the brain. So a bad infection in the otitis media can extend rather rapidly into the temporal lobe of the brain. This other star reminds me to tell you that the cranial nerve 7 courses through the bone here, and infection in the middle ear can extend into the 7th nerve and cause a Bell's palsy. This last star down here reminds you of the Eustachian tube, which is connected to the torus in the back of the nasal pharynx, is the way we get air into our ear, and also when we blow our nose, how we get nasopharyngeal secretions into the middle ear that causes otitis media. What about swimmer's ear? If rumen builds up, typically in a younger person, but moisture that can form, which causes maceration of the canal lining, then you get cellulitis of the external auditory canal. Canal gets red, edematous, full of debris and cerumen. Tugging on the ear is painful, which means the infection is in the canal itself. This can be Staph aureus epidermidis or Cutibacterium acnes, but it doesn't need antibiotics. It needs gentle irrigation and cleansing. Sometimes an ENT doc will put a gauze wick into the canal if it's clogged, just to allow the Burow's ear drops or the ciprohydrocortisone drops to get deeper into the external auditory canal. Acute otitis media occurs when the Eustachian tube is blocked, and particularly young kids below 4, and when adenoids or viral infections block the torus, the Eustachian tube. These are nasopharyngeal flora, and they get into the middle ear and causes pain and hearing loss. The TM gets red and bulgy and immobile. Pneumococcus is a bit more of the leading pathogen. Secondary is non-typable H flu or occasionally Moraxella. And we treat that with first generation cephalosporins or a variety of other drugs. Let's go on to the case of a serious infection. And this is a 70-year-old man. He's a retired naval officer, actually a retired admiral in the Navy. And he presents in the emergency room with increasing pain in his left ear. Been going on for only a couple of days, was already pretty bad. He'd been seen in a walk-in clinic and given Augmentin and some ear drops, but it kept getting worse. He just couldn't stand the pain, so he came in. And even lying his head on a pillow hurt. And he can't sleep at night because of the pain. His hearing feels stopped up. And he didn't have any chills or fever or cough. No pain on chewing, meaning his temporal mandibular joint is, at this point, is not infected. He does have a past history of type 2 diabetes and is taking metformin. His temp's 38, pulse 92, blood pressure 140 over 90, and the external auditory canal is blocked by edema and cerumen, so you actually can't see the tympanic membrane, but tugging on the left ear is very painful. The mastoids are not tender, and there's no preauricular lymphadenopathy. His white count's up a sniff at 11.5, but his resting metabolic panel is normal, except his glucose is high. Despite the metformin, his glucose is 180. And so what's going on here? What do you think the pathogen is? I'm going to give you some choices here. In this 77-year-old man with severe ear pain and an inflamed canal, is that Staph aureus? Is this Aspergillus fumigatus? Streptococcus pyogenes, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, or Rhizopus oryzus, that is mucormycosis? So let's have you vote, then we'll see what the answer is. And the answer is Pseudomonas aeruginosa, because this has been called malignant or necrotizing otitis externa, a very serious infection. So here's more about it on this slide. Patients are almost all diabetics or elderly. And then they get rapidly increasing pain in the ear canal. It gets very severe. And the fever is low grade or absent. The canal, when you look in on an otoscope, looks boggy. It's red. There may be some pus. If you do see the tympanic membrane, it does look normal. The pinna, the external ear, is painful if you tug on it. The hearing is normal unless the canal is blocked by edema or debris. So this is infection not of the middle ear, but the external auditory canal. So it goes rather rapidly, unfortunately, and it can go into the temporal mandibular joint and cause pain on chewing. Or it can get medial into the seventh nerve and cause a seventh nerve palsy, but that's after several days later in the course. The temporal bone does get involved, so there is an osteomyelitis, which is why we treat this for 4 to 6 weeks. It can go into the posterior fossa around the cerebellum and cause a thrombophlebitis of the sigmoid sinus and give you a very similar period picture as Lemierre's, which is of the jugular vein thrombophlebitis. Or it could go up from the middle ear and into the brain and cause a brain abscess. Pseudomonas aeruginosa is almost always the pathogen. So you have to give drugs that are effective for that, such as Pictazo, ceftazidime, or cefepime, and treat it for 4 to 6 weeks, or it will come back, unfortunately. Here's another painful ear, 70-year-old female. Been in excellent health, but the last 3 days she's had a stabbing pain and itching in her left ear. And on the second day of the pain, the pain extended into her left jaw, spreading around that part of her cheek. And chewing caused some pain in the, and she had some difficulty swallowing. And the hearing was poor in her left ear. So on exam, she was afebrile and alert and oriented, but she had some erythematous vesicles and moistness in her left external auditory canal. And she was getting a seventh nerve palsy, so there's some flattening of her nasolabial fold, and there was a lesser smile on the left. She did have a sense of neural hearing loss on exam, and her tympanic membrane could not be visualized because when you tried to stick your otoscope into the ear, it hurt so much she asked you to please stop. Okay, healthy woman, she's got ear pain, she's got vesicles, and got a Bell's palsy. So what do you want to test? There's an exudate in the ear, and shall we do a Gram stain and a routine bacterial culture? Or what about a fungal smearing culture? Or a PCR for herpes simplex? Or maybe a PCR for varicella zoster virus? Or how about an acid fast smearing culture? Please vote. The answer is a PCR for varicella zoster virus. Why? Because this is the Ramsey-Hunt syndrome that you'll also hear about from Rich Whitley talking about herpes viruses. So this is a herpes zoster, the dedicular ganglion of the seventh cranial nerve. So there's pain in the ear, there's vesicles in the external auditory canal, and very early on a Bell's palsy, because this is an infection of the seventh nerve. It can extend to the eighth cranial nerve because they both run together in the internal auditory canal. So the involvement of the eighth nerve can certainly drop your hearing. It can cause vertigo or tinnitus. And that's a bad prognostic sign, because the infection, if it's extended from the seventh to the eighth nerve, means you may end up with permanent loss of both seventh and eighth nerve function. The seventh nerve has a branch called the corner tympani, and it goes to the anterior third of the tongue on the left side. And that can cause taste distortion, numb or burning, but patients usually don't notice even that. The ear hurts so much they don't tell you about anything wrong with their taste, but if asked, they may tell you that. Early, you should don't rely on valacyclovir, in my opinion. Go straight to intravenous acyclovir. You want to decrease the chance of permanent nerve damage to the seventh and the eighth nerve. Let's switch gears now and talk about chronic otitis media or mastoiditis. I'm not going to give you a case of that, but these are patients that are referred by ENT because they've had recurrent episodes of otitis media, and they have chronic drainage from the ear and a perforated tympanic membrane, and the hearing is down in part because the TM is perforated. They may have a cholesteatoma form inside or a retraction pocket of the tympanic membrane, and they can, or the cholesteatoma can erode the bone, which are the ossicles of the middle ear. The therapy is a mastoidectomy, scraping out the air cells of the mastoid and removing the cholesteatoma. They require prolonged antibiotics, and that's where we tend to get involved. It can be nontuberculous mycobacterium aspergillus and TB rarely, but it's usually bacteria. So here's a case of a 22-year-old man. He has 2 years of painous periodontal drainage, and he's had progressive hearing loss. This is his right ear. It's now a fairly profound hearing loss in that one ear. It's been treated numerous times with various antibacterial drugs for Staph aureus or Pseudomonas, but it maybe got a bit a little better, but really not. And so what about his past history? He was born in Korea, but he's been living in San Francisco since he's age 11. He's afebrile. There are no night sweats, and there's no weight loss, and there's no remarkable physical findings or laboratory findings, except for this extensive granulation tissue and drainage in this right external auditory canal. There's a very large and peripheral tympanic membrane perforation. His HIV testing is negative. The CT imaging of his chest is normal, but a CT scan shows partial pacification of the right mastoid air cells. Okay, Korean-born man with 2 years of painless ear drainage. What do you think is the cause of this? Don't forget, for the boards, there are internal medicine questions. What about Wegener's granulomatosis with polyangiitis? Syphilis can do so many things. Is this syphilis? What about all the cartilage in this area? Is this really polychondritis? Could this be tuberculosis? There was a lot of TB when he was growing up in South Korea. What about actinomycosis? That certainly can be chronic. So let's have you vote. All right. So this is the patient actually has tuberculosis. So what about tuberculous otitis? It's usually unilateral, relatively painless, and progresses over months, or in his case, a couple of years. The TM is almost always perforated, typically a marginal perforation, and there's drainage in the canal, and there's mastoid fluid if you do a CT of the mastoid area. so they may have preauricular adenopathy. There's an ipsilateral facial palsy may occur, and the infection may extend to the contiguous bone in the brain. The chest CT is normal, even though that's obviously the place, the portal of entry. The CT doesn't show a lesion in half the patients. How do you make the diagnosis? Well, it's usually pretty easy because the acid vast smear is very positive. You want to get a culture looking for drug resistance. You get a quicker answer if you get PCR of the drainage if the acid vast smear is negative. You can do a biopsy, but usually that's not necessary. It can help you rule out Wegener's. Granulomatosis with polyangiitis. Usually, why is it not that? Remember, this is a disease that involves the lung, the paranasal sinus, or the kidney. And so if you have none of those, it's very unlikely to be Wegener's. Here's another case. 56-year-old woman with insulin-dependent diabetes. She presents with 1 week of worsening right-sided headache and a new-onset horizontal diplopia. It's worse when she's looking to the right side. So this is the right sixth nerve palsy. For several weeks, she's had chronic purulent drainage from her right ear. It's otorrhea, and a perforated tubatic membrane is found in her right side. On a neurologic exam, shows inability to abduct the right eye, a sixth nerve palsy. So which of the following explains the mechanism of her neurologic findings? So this is a woman with a draining ear, headache, and a Bell's palsy. So what's going on? Is this reactivation of varicella zoster virus in the geniculate ganglion? Is this extension of middle ear infection to the petrous apex involving the sixth nerve? Is this invasive fungal infection of the external auditory canal? Is this granulomatous inflammation of the small and medium-sized arteries, that is Wegener's? Or is this cavernous sinus thrombosis due to hematogenous spread? Pick one of these. So this is Gradenigo syndrome. Let's start looking at the CT on the bottom right here. And see the circle? That is around the mastoid air cells, which are filled with fluid because this is a chronic mastoiditis. See in that same CT, the white arrow, that's pointing to a part of the bone, which is called the temporal bone, and the infection extends along that temporal bone. Now look at the MRI to the left there, and you see the white arrow. As the infection extends along, it gets the area, which is called the petrous apex, and that's also where the sixth nerve is. So you end up with a chronic mastoiditis and an osteomyelitis that ends up in an abscess causing a sixth nerve palsy. It is treated with intravenous antibiotics. Usually does not require surgery. It may. And you may later on in the course of treatment have to offer a mastoid surgery. Moving away to the poor little monkey with the maxillary sinus pain and sinusitis, let's look at some pictures of the sinus. Let's start on the left where you see the sphenoid sinus is behind the nasal pharynx. The better look at the other sinus is on the right side where you see the frontal sinus. And then the ethmoid sinus is very important because there's a very thin membrane between the ethmoid sinus and the orbit. So the infection can easily extend across that thin membrane, bony membrane, which is called the lamina papyracea, paper thin, into the orbit. Or you could have infection in the maxillary sinus as shown also here. But that rarely gets into the orbit. Here's another case for you. This is January. We're in Chicago and we have a 30-year-old woman. She's been in excellent health, but now she's had purulent nasal drainage and fevers of 38.5. Got a sore throat and Ehrman chills. It's going on now 12 days. She has been able to work and exercise at her treadmill as she usually does, but she's easily fatigued, and she did see her primary care physician after 5 days of this sinusitis. And the primary care said, just hang in there. You don't need antibiotics because this is probably viral. The symptoms won't last long, and it'll resolve, so just be patient. But she's now, this is now not day five, this is day 12, and she comes to you as an ID physician. She wants another opinion. Obviously, she wants something more than nasal washes. So she's has a temperature of 38.3 and intermittent chills and moderate pain over her sinus. And she has a permanent-looking nasal drainage, and her white count is normal, though, and she has no drug allergies. So we have a healthy woman with acute sinus, 12 days. She's looking for treatment, but what are you going to do? You say, maybe not. Let's give her nasal decongestants and nasal irrigation with saline twice a day for 3 to 5 days, but really no antibiotics. And if it gets worse, we'll think about that. But the alternative is maybe give her clindamycin, or maybe cefalexin, amoxicillin, clavulate, analate, augmentin, or maybe Cipro. Pick one, and please vote. And the answer, according to the IDSA recommendations, is amoxicillin clavulanate. Fever and 12 days suggest this is bacterial, despite the normal white count. And why do we want to give the clavulanate? Why not just amoxicillin? Because there could be a beta-lactamase producing non-tabable H. flu or Moraxella. And of course, it could be a pneumococcus as well, but the clavulanate is going to take care of that for her. Let's have another case here. An otolaryngologist referred an 18-year-old male from Baltimore following sinus surgery because the hyphae were seen in the histopathology of the sinus tissue from that surgery. So the patient originally had sought help from his internist for months of gradually increasing painous protrusion of his left eye. He had been otherwise well, but he did have a history of hay fever and allergic rhinitis, and he'd sometimes use nasal sprays with a decongestant or corticosteroid. On exam, he was afebrile and had proptosis of his left eye, but the visual acuity of that bulging eye was normal. The internist ordered a sinus CT, which we'll see in a minute, and the ethmoid sinus was full of tissue on the CT, and the walls bulged into the orbit, and that's why the eye was bulging outward. So here's the expansal mass filling the left ethmoid sinus. You see the white arrow pointing to the ethmoid sinus, and the lamina preparation is bulging out and pushing into the orbit and pushing. That's why the painless proptosis is there. Notice that instead of having just air in those cells in the ethmoid sinus, they're all full of tissue, which we'll find out when we do the surgery, that there's sticky dark mucus is curated in the sinuses, but the mucosa was, the attack was hyperplastic, bulging out. What did the past show? Well, there were occasional hyphae and mucus, that's what got the ENT doc's attention, but there was no trouble with the mucosal lining, it was intact. And within that sticky mucus, there were eosinophils and occasional Charcot-laden crystals, which are collections of eosinophils. The culture had been sent off and grew something, but it was a brown mold, and had been sent to a reference laboratory for identification because the lab couldn't identify it. So I'm going to ask you to make some choices here. So this is an allergic boy with painless proptosis, and there's that CT down on the right that you saw before. So what do you think you're going to recommend to the patient and to the ENT doc? The surgical removal of the sinus tonsils, if you did that already, you did a good job of that, that's kind of the end of it. No, we better give him metronidazole or posaconazole, or maybe even amphotericin B. This is in the pushing into the orbit, that maybe this could get very serious. Or maybe just the nasal wash with amphotericin B. Make a choice. Well, this is allergic fungal sinusitis, and removal of all the sinus contents is all that's needed. These are healthy patients with a nasal obstruction, and they present often with painless proptosis. And following surgery, it's important to do endoscopy and a CT to see if there's stuff left that's going to relapse, because if so, it'll likely continue to grow and very slowly cause the same thing all over again. But the antifungals have no role. Some ENT docs will use nasal corticosteroid sprays or dupilumab to prevent recurrence. There's not really good data that helps, and you're not part of that decision-making tree. There's a review that's cited here in Laryngoscope back in 2001, and it points out this could be really any age between 3 and 74 in that series, and the median in that particular series was 31 years. There's a 1-to-1 male-to-female ratio. There's a prior history of nasal polyps in 95%, allergic rhinitis in 84%, and asthma in a fair proportion, 41%. Yeah, peripheral eosinophilia is also very common at 70%, and a high IgE in the peripheral blood at 83%. We're not going to talk about acute fungal sinusitis, but to remind you, these are covered in the mycoses lecture, and they occur in aspergillosis with prolonged neutropenia, more than 2 weeks typically, transplant patients and immunosuppressed patients. Mucormycosis, yes, you can be immunosuppressed or just have poorly controlled diabetes mellitus. Moving on to another problem of the sinuses. A 23-year-old, previously healthy lady presents with a 2-day history of progressive red and painful right eye and low-grade fever. Her vision is slightly blurred. She has no history of local trauma or recent surgery and is aware of no other recent illness. She works in retail in Chicago. She's sexually active and had a new male partner. On physical exam, she is febrile to 38.3, and she has right ophthalmoplegia involving all the third, the fourth, and the sixth nerve. And her right eyelid is swollen erythematous. Her right pupil reacts sluggishly to light, and there is marked chemosis, periocular edema, and proptosis. The retina appears normal. Her laboratory exam is normal except for a white count elevated 17,000 with 90% neutrophils. The HIV test is negative. So here's a picture of that. 2 days painful, swollen red eye. What do you think this is? Staphylococcal blepharitis, gonococcal conjunctivitis, bacterial orbital cellulitis, bacterial septal cellulitis, or is this Behçet's disease? Please vote. So the answer is bacterial orbital cellulitis. The things that are called preseptal are in the front of the eye, the eyelids, the conjunctiva, the skin around the eye. But this patient's infection definitely goes more posterior than that. So she has a postseptal infection and interorbital. So she has an orbital cellulitis. Usually originates from the ethmoid sinus, which is why we're talking about it when we're talking about sinusitis. They have fever, leukocytosis, and they're typically a vision loss early, and unfortunately often permanent. It's treated with IV antibiotics and sinus surgery. So this is not cavernous sinus thrombophlebitis, although there's a similar presentation. They have late loss of vision and high fever because it is an infection in the vascular tree, in the cavernous sinus. And the source could be in the sinus or the face. So back to our monkeys. Too much information, too many slides. Time to stop talking, which I will, and thank you.